Mark 14, a very famous story, one which is a great favorite of mine, and I wanted to include it in this series. You remember that the purpose of this series, Toward Fullness of Blessing, was to look at the number of things the Bible has to say about fullness of life. I have felt for some time that when Christians talk of fullness of life and full salvation, they talk far too much in narrow terms, as though one truth and one passage in the Bible contained all the secrets. Of course, that isn't so. And here is a great secret revealed to us in the story of Mary of Bethany and what she did for Jesus. Verse 3. Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, and as he sat at table, a woman came in carrying a small bottle of very costly perfume, oil of pure nard. She broke it open and poured the oil over his head. Some of those present said to one another angrily, "Why this waste? Perfume might have been sold for 30 pounds and the money given to the poor," and they turned upon her with fury. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why must you make trouble for her? It is a fine, beautiful thing she has done for me. You have the poor among you always, and you can help them whenever you like, but you will not always have me. She has done what lay in her power. She is beforehand with anointing my body for burial. I tell you this, wherever in all the world the gospel is proclaimed, what she has done will be told as her memorial." Just a word or two about this gospel. Mark got this gospel from the preaching of Peter. That's an ancient tradition, but almost certainly a true one. It goes right back to the early years of the gospel records. And it's rather significant, I think, that all we know of Mark is that tremendous failure of his, of course, recorded in Acts 15, when because of immaturity he'd probably set out on Christian service far too soon, and the Apostle Paul, you remember, wouldn't have him. And there was this tremendous dissension between Paul and Barnabas because of it. And so Mark was in the doghouse from then on, as far as one can see in the record. But it's very interesting that at the end of Paul's last letter to Timothy, chapter 4, verse 11, Paul says to Timothy in the instructions he gives, "Get Mark and bring him to me, because he's very useful to me in the ministry, in service." So it's quite remarkable that at the beginning of Paul's ministry and the end of his Paul's ministry, he has such a great difference of opinion over this young man, John Mark. In those years, between those years, John Mark had become a very great servant of God. And it is at least suggestive that during those years he had undoubtedly accompanied Peter in his preaching ministry. He must therefore have heard the stories of the gospel over and over again. He then wrote them down and committed them to paper. And what has been noticed from the earliest years of the church is that St. Mark's gospel has a special interest in any situation in the life of Jesus connected with service, the service of God. It's as though Mark, hearing these stories again and again in marketplace and village and open air, suddenly realized that Jesus was the pattern servant of God, and if he wanted to be a great servant, he must follow that example. And if you make a comparison of the stories as told in Mark with, for example, Matthew, you will always find, without exception, that Mark has chosen those incidents and those words that bring out the principles of Christian service. Now, before we look at the principles that are here, I want to whet your appetite. Again, will you notice how often the Bible does this? The Bible writers know very well that it's easy to find out what we've got to do, what is not so easy as to want to do it. It's pretty easy for me to explain these things to you now. It's very different from me myself to live them, and for you too. And so, first of all, we have our appetite whetted. We see what happened as a result of this action. It's a very remarkable action, isn't it? Verse 3, she has this family heirloom. Apparently, some commentators say, it would have had a little gadget on it, and a little tiny bit of this oil would have come out normally and been rather a compliment to your guest. But in fact, impulsively and extravagantly, she breaks the lot and pours it over Christ. It was quite unnecessary, strictly speaking, and certainly uneconomical. This action is chosen by Jesus in the providence of God to give us mighty lessons, and I want you to notice, first of all, that her action was praised. Jesus is quite clear about it. He turns on her critics, says, "Why do you make trouble for her? It's a beautiful thing she's done. I am pleased with it." Now surely this is the first ideal that you want for your life of Christian service, to please Christ. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:9 that he made it his ambition to please Jesus. This happened as a result of his conversion. And if it isn't an ambition of yours to please Christ, then you must doubt whether you're truly converted. Because this becomes one of the underwriting desires of a newly converted person. He desires to please Jesus Christ in what he does. And you'll know if you love somebody at home what pleasure it is to you to give them a present, to do something for them that you know that they're looking forward to. It's interesting that in the Bible, for example, Revelation 4:11, that we are told that the whole creation is made with one specific purpose, for his pleasure. Again, a tremendous insight, isn't it? Where they're told, nobody else believes it but Christians, that the whole of this universe is made to please Jesus Christ. I think personally that this explains why people who don't live the Christian life find that they are frustrated. It's one of the reasons. Because, of course, they're going against the grain that God has built into everything. God has built in this grain into the universe. It is here to please Christ. When you become a Christian, you begin to fit into the way that God's things work. It's not here for our pleasure. It's for his pleasure. Great reminder. Her action was praised. Secondly, will you notice that her action was attractive? Two Greek words for good. One means good, morally good, and one means good and beautiful. And the word here is good and beautiful, translated in the NEB, fine, though I prefer the word beautiful myself. Now, I wonder, is Christian service and Christian holiness always attractive? It may be good morally. I wonder if young people have in their minds the idea that moral goodness is attractive. I'm afraid very often the reverse. Young people very often think that goodness, holiness, and service is rather unattractive and dreary. And surely it is true that the church, when it gets away from Christ, always produces an ideal of service which is a bit sub-fusc and dreary, for example, asceticism. I don't think there's any call for dreariness here. The principle, the hint here, is that if we serve Christ, we ought to become attractive to others. And I thought this at Filey again. I had the privilege of being in the speaker's team at Filey last week, and I was very struck by the fact that I meet some of those men only about once every 2 or 3 years, and yet I am tremendously attracted to many of them. And you say, now what is attractive in this man? We've got very little in common except Christ, maybe. He may come from Scotland and I come from south of the Thames and so on. And then you, of course, realize what it is. It is that the attractiveness is Christ in him. So the second thing about this is that it's attractive. But notice, please, and I brought this point in especially for this purpose, it is not attractive to everybody. There are some harsh critics here who come in and say this is an appalling waste. I have a favorite story here that you may have heard me tell concerning two lads that I helped over their ordination training some years ago when I was with the Church Pastoral Aid Society. At least I helped the second one. The older brother had been a Christian for some time when he felt God's call to full-time service in the ordained ministry. And his parents, who were not believing Christians, raised no objection. But I vividly remember when, 2 or 3 years later, the younger brother also felt and heard a call to the ministry, that there was the most tremendous shindy at home. Because the younger brother had about 85 A-levels and had got scholarship papers at about 6 universities. And his parents said, his father said to him, my dear sir, why waste this gift? Why waste these brains? And the brains of the ministry. And this is characteristic of the world, isn't it? You see, the elder son was a normal, ordinary fellow. Well, yes, if you want to go into the ministry, fair enough. Parents didn't raise any objections. But the second one, no, it's a waste. You've got gifts. You could make a lot of money. I think that the world does often say this about Christian service done by ordinary Christian people, isn't it? Why waste your evenings? Why do you waste your time at weekends? Think of what you could be doing. I always have three E's which I give young Christians on criticism, if I may give. If you're a young Christian, will you note them down? Because they're important. They come from 1 Peter 4:14-16. We haven't time to turn to it. The three E's are these. Expect it. Examine it. And thirdly, endure it. Cheerfully. And I think that second E is important. It's interesting that when Peter, in 1 Peter 4:14-16, tells them to count themselves happy and expect criticism, he adds the little caveat, if you're criticized, it must not be for murder, theft, sorcery, or being a busybody. Shrewd, isn't it, that? In other words, if you're criticized, just look and see that you didn't deserve to be. There's usually 5% of truth, isn't there, in a criticism? The Christian who will never receive it as an unwise Christian, expect it, examine it, endure it. Now next, I want you to see that her gift was used, verse 8. What an astonishing thing verse 8 is. She cannot have understood what this meant. No one can have understood what this phrase meant. She is anointing my body for burial. They cannot have known until a few hours later, recorded at the beginning of Mark 16, when the two Marys and Salome very early on the Sunday morning, just after sunrise, came to the tomb, found the stone rolled away. The angel heard the words, "Fear not, you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is risen. But go and give this message." They must have gone back, not only excited but terrified as well, awestruck by this, to say that they'd been unable to anoint the body of Jesus. Now, don't you think that Mary must have been really rather thrilled when she realized that what that sentence that had been spoken to her those hours before had meant? Jesus knew that there would be no time to anoint his body, but he had no intention that that privilege should be kept back from him. And so he allows her the privilege of anointing him. He says, in fact, this work that you have done is significant. I will use it. I have in my study behind the organ there a great many useful things, files and books and things I can't do without. But I also have some ornamental things that aren't particularly useful. I have a little black cat with a blue skirt and skis that was given to me on the ski party last winter. Now, I haven't actually found a use for this cat yet. They're very nice to have. And I think some of us are rather like that in the Christian church, aren't we? We're ornamental rather than useful. I think this is a simple ideal that we want, don't we, as Christians? We want to be useful. We want God to use us. Here, I think, there's an encouragement that she didn't know that God had used this till later. And we often do not know if God has used our lives and our witness until later. An encouragement to realize that God is able to weave everything into his purposes if it is done for the sake of Jesus Christ. And then last of all, you notice that her action had a permanent result, a permanent impact, a lasting influence, verse 9. This, of all the sentences that Jesus speaks in these last days, must surely have been most staggering to his disciples. There they were in a tiny corner of the Middle East, facing the worst news they've ever heard, which is that Jesus is about to die, and if that is so, the story will come to an end. But Jesus says, wherever in all the world the good news is proclaimed, what she has done will be told. So he flatly contradicts all the things that seem to be true. They say, this is bad news. He says it is good news. It looks as though it's all coming to an end in a tiny little part of the world. He says the whole world will know about it. It looks as though the story is at an end, and he says the story has just begun. Now, I think there is an illustration there, isn't there, that God intends what we do to be of lasting value. And he took this woman's gift and he made it of lasting value, and here it is at the end of September 1967 that we are putting the best powers of our mind to this story together. Isn't that amazing? They say, don't they, the psychologists, that people put their initials on St. Paul's Cathedral and so on, you know, JTB, and then a heart and an arrow, ABC, not because they love ABC, but because they want to have a lasting place in history. And I expect the psychologists are talking nonsense, but there is something in all of us, isn't there, that wants to have a lasting effect. I often quote Lady Barnett on the any answers, isn't it, or any questions, when they were asked, what do you want to achieve with your life? And for the first time, this gifted panel had nothing to say. And the question master was looking rather anxious, but at last Lady Barnett held forth and she said she wanted to leave this world a happier place than she found it. Which I always think is cliche number one of the 1960s. Because it is sheer cliche, isn't it? Sheer cliche means nothing. Just illustrates the fact that people don't think. You don't leave the world a happier place than you found it. The world goes on much the same, doesn't it? In any large degree. So I see there a simple ideal for ordinary people like ourselves, for our lives, which is very appetite-whetting, at least I think it is. I hope you do. Her gift was praised. Do you want that for your life? You say yes. Good. Her gift, her service to Christ, was attractive and beautiful. It was something that was attractive to all to see. And we are attracted as we see what she did, the impulsiveness, the love that was there. Thirdly, it was used. Well, I suppose that's really the key to it. It wasn't useless. And fourthly, it was to be remembered. It was going to last. Well, now, if your appetite in any way is whetted by that, then it seems to me you are bound to look for the secrets which are here in this story. And there are, I think, two guiding principles here, which are only hints. When you're reading gospel stories, you have to be careful to take hints. You don't prove things by these stories, these illustrations. You have to prove them by the rest of the New Testament. But I think you'll agree with me as I look at these hints that these are underlined throughout the New Testament. They're very simple at first, but they're exceedingly profound. First, the first hint is in verse 6. She has done it for me. In other words, this had as its ultimate aim and purpose service of me, myself, says Christ. Now that's commonplace, you might say, Paul and Timothy, when they write to the Philippians, say, Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ. And you might say it is simply obvious, platitudinous, to say it a Christian is a servant of Jesus Christ. Well, I'm going to suggest that it's nothing like as obvious as it looks. And there are two dangers that beset us on every side. First, we can, in our Christian service, be serving ourselves. And I turn you to what is one of the great verses of the New Testament. Every Christian ought to know this verse by heart, I think, because it contains within it a vital secret of Christian service. Mark 10:45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to surrender his life a ransom for many. Now you see what a platitudinous statement that would have been if Mark had recorded the Son of Man came to serve. But he doesn't do that. He puts in a negative qualification. He says the Son of Man did not come to be served. A young fellow is just converted. He's asked by the youth leader to give a testimony. He stands up on his hind legs and he gives a testimony, and it's quite a thrilling one. But afterwards, nobody comes up to thank him for it and tell him what a marvelous testimony it was, and the youth leader forgot to do it too. And this young fellow goes back home thoroughly disgruntled. Why is he disgruntled? Why is it that he can't sleep easily that night? Why is it that he's disappointed with that meeting? Well, it was because, you see, deep down, he came not only to serve by his testimony, but to be served. Now, I've certainly caught myself on this many, 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 many times. Lurking inside us all is the self that longs to be served, that has a voracious appetite for people's praise. We're all men pleasers, aren't we? Every one of us. How many churches know the Christian worker who, unless constantly thanked, will be in a huff? How many Christian ministers live in daily dread that somebody else will put a flower on the font at Harvest Festival because Mrs. Sands has done it for 30 years? You see, she didn't come to serve the church. She came to be served. She's done it for 30 years. It's her perks. What a menace for everybody else. That's not service, is it? This devastating sentence goes to the heart, I believe. It certainly goes to the heart for me on motives and is a constant reminder that in our Christian service, we can all the time, unknown even to ourselves unless the Word of God reveals it to us, want to be served. Why, what a tremendous success I am. 14 people come to my Bible study. I haven't lost one. Oh, Joe, here's a Bible study up the other end of the church. He only gets 10. And I think it was 9 last week. It's going to be 8 next week. We don't mean to say that, do we? But it comes up so quickly and easily, doesn't it? That church, they seem to be more successful evangelistically than we are. They're Baptists. You see? See what it is? We come to be served, don't we? Not to serve. Well, there isn't one of us who isn't open to that tremendous temptation. But then there's another danger, isn't there, in serving, and that is not simply to serve ourselves, but to serve others full stop. And here, I think, is something really to stretch our minds and to think about this week, because for me, this has been, although it's in a sense something that I'd seen in the story before, come home to me with fresh thought. Service is such an ideal in England, isn't it? Thank God for it. It's part of our heritage from Christianity. So that the armed forces are services. So that the corridors of Whitehall are ministries. That shares Christian influence originally, doesn't it? But if people have had this ideal of service, of course, if you get away from Jesus Christ, things start to go wrong. Now, you see, there's a tremendous contrast in this story, which at first is rather shocking. Why wasn't this money sold, this perfume sold for £30, that's a year's wage of a working man, and given to the poor? And indeed, you might ask that question, why not? Surely Christ wants us to be practical. And this amazing answer in verse 7, you've got the poor always with you, and you can help them whenever you will, but you haven't always got me, said that here Christ deliberately, provocatively, says, I come before the poor. What does that mean? I think it means that if we serve others, the needy, without reference to Christ, things will go wrong. Let me try and illustrate this. Next door to us, Spitalfields, in the crypt, they've had a very tough time. They've had professions of conversion among some of these tramps and methylated spirits drinkers and so on. I don't know that I've got all my details correct, but one man, I think, there professed conversion and went on as a leader amongst the other men for 3 months and then suddenly disappeared. Gone back to his old ways. A warning to us, incidentally, that with these men, as with young drug addicts and that sort of thing, a large number of conversions that are reported sometimes in the Christian press in exaggerated language do not necessarily mean that a life has been entirely rescued and changed. Because if your moral fiber has gone, you need a great deal of the power of God to have a changed life. Now, what happens? Well, you see, again and again, when that sort of thing happens, people begin to be discouraged and work starts to close down, doesn't it? National Association of Boys Club are going everywhere to find anybody who will run youth clubs, boys clubs in London. And I think it is thrilling to see that more and more boys clubs in London that are working are being run by Christians. Because, you see, you've got to be jolly patient, haven't you? You do all these things, and everybody takes it now in this welfare state age, don't they? They don't give you any thanks for it, and you perhaps come and bust up your newly painted hall. Well, there aren't many people who will survive this, are there? Unless they've got a deeper motive. If you're simply wanting to serve drug people or the lads in the neighborhood, you're not going to last very long if that is your only motive. And everywhere you see it, clubs that have closed, difficult pieces of work that cannot be staffed, lack of perseverance in the things that are really difficult. Now, what more can we say about this? I think we could say many things. I haven't time for them, but if I may link this with the other point, serving other people is not only exhausting and difficult without a desire to serve Christ in and through it, but serving others can also be simply a royal road to serving ourselves, can it? Can it not? How many people who serve, in fact, dominate? Is it not really that many people feel this of politicians so often that has made people cynical about politicians? Are they really serving? They say so, don't they, in their manifestos. They want to serve the country, but are they really serving? We know, of course, that they're not, again and again. They want to be served. That is natural to our human nature. It's not different from anybody else. How irritating, though, it is if you put yourself in the position of the needy to be served by someone who will only serve you in that kind of way. Here is an old dear in one room at the end of her days. She has her only sister who lives 20 miles away, and the only thing she wants is that someone should drive her to her sister's once a fortnight so that she may have a gossip. She enjoys the drive and she wants to talk. But this is simply a caricature. I'm going to suppose that she cannot get that. She can get anything else. The young people will come and strip her walls and put on new wallpaper. The social worker will call and give her 3 Darby and Joan parties a week. Someone will come and give her a bath that she doesn't want. But the one thing she cannot get is some Christian woman who will spare 3 hours to waste her time, really, to give her this drive, to wait for an hour and a half while she gossips, which will be a complete waste of time for the person who drives her, and to take her home again. But I think although that is a caricature, it points a tremendously important thing, isn't it? The difference between service that serves and service that doesn't. And how do you get that sensitivity to the real needs of people? Well, I believe this story contains the answer. It is that we've got to have Jesus at the heart of our service. Now, I'm going to make a comparison here with Luke 11, which I think is a very important one, because I think that Mary had learnt this sensitivity from this astonishing story, Luke 10, in verse 38 to 42 that we know so well. And you remember that we who in the 20th century sympathize with Martha get rather a shock because Mary is praised. End of Luke 10. And the sentence at the end is very confused, really, and many of the translations differ. But I believe that literally, really, what is in this sentence is this. Martha, Martha, verse 41, you are fretting and fussing about so many things, but one course is all I wanted. That's probably what he means. You see, she'd produced a tremendous celebratory feast. She said, I don't want that. I don't want one thing. And then again, the word can be used for food. This portion Mary has chosen. And that is so, it's a very remarkable play on words to make them remember. I only want some refreshment. I don't want a feast. And the portion that Mary has chosen is the most important one, which is to listen to me, because that's what I want at the moment. I have a great deal I want to say to you. As a result of not being sensitive to what he wanted, do you see that Martha was thoroughly distracted? She got out of sorts with Christ, she got out of sorts with her sister, thorough row going on, and she was distracted with herself. Now, when I'm in a kitchen getting a meal, I get distracted, but I'm a bachelor. Martha had no business to be distracted in her kitchen. She ought to have been a professional. And if you find Christian workers who are distracted in work they ought to know how to do, and are falling out with their fellow workers, and are falling out with the Lord too, and are beginning to say, is it really worth serving God? You nearly always find lurking underneath that they have forgotten, at least this is true in my life, a lot forgotten the end of verse 42. But I didn't want you to do that. I wanted you to listen. The simple illustration could be taken of an army in the field. It isn't any good for a young lieutenant to say, we'll have a good old smash up here and shoot through there. He's got to get his line back to the commander-in-chief. He doesn't help the army unless he serves the plan that is on the table. Surely God must be very frustrated when we cease really to pray and to wait on him morning by morning, but are full of activity. So there is a double warning here of tremendous depth, I think, and perception in the story of Mark 14. The danger in our Christian service of serving ourselves, that's pretty obvious, but the danger of just being content with service, which has no reference to the head of the church. And there is the reminder, though, that unless I tune in morning by morning, I am going to get insensitive to what God really wants of me. So the first great principle there to be worked out is she's done it for me. All Christian service has Christ at the center. No Christian has any right to serve the poor, the lame, the blind, youth, old age, anybody, except for Christ's sake. And that will make, or ought to make in the long run, a very great difference according to this story. Now, last of all, the second hint. She has done what she could, verse 8. Two very powerful short sentences. She's done it for me. She's done what she could. I'm very suspicious of some of the phrases much beloved by Victorian holiness teachers, like entire consecration. I have never been entirely consecrated, and in case you didn't know it, nor have you. If you're consecrated today, the Lord will soon show you tomorrow some area of your life that has never received his refining power. We go on in the Christian life realizing just how little of us has begun to be consecrated. And I think it's important to realize that when we've done our very best in terms of service, we are unprofitable servants. But here is a simple biblical principle. It is so sane for ordinary Christians. There are two things in this. First, a comfort. She has done what she could. N.E.B., she has done what lay in her power. Now, Jesus does not want more than that. And I've asked myself the question this morning as I prepared, I know it's true of me, do we sometimes try to do too much? I haven't thought this one fully through yet, but I leave it to you for your notes and for your thought. I was talking to a very remarkable Christian businessman the other day who tries to bring into his departments young Christians. And he said, well, you know, I've got thoroughly discouraged about this. He said, I've had young Christians from my own church in, and when I'm out or on an important engagement, I find they've disappeared at 4:30. And when I asked for an explanation next morning, they said, oh, they were taking a Bible study. It was obvious they thought I would understand. And we're really rather shaken when they got a rocket. You see, their duty at that time, what Jesus was asking them to do in Christian service was to work until 5 p.m. But they thought that Christian service, which was much more important, was the Bible class. And they thought everybody would understand. And it may be that we're trying to do too much, and Jesus would say, you've got to do that part well, you cannot therefore do this in addition. She has done what she could. Not everybody's called to be a great soul winner. You know, that's quite false. Everybody is called to witness. Many of us ought to have the ability to be great soul winners, but not everybody. In your local church at home, there will be many people who are far too shy or without capacity or without tact sometimes, without the natural gifts or the supernatural gifts, really to be effective as soul winners. But there are many people who can do other things as Mary could. And incidentally, on the business level, how many Christian things, missionary societies and Christian activities, are hopeless when it comes to administration. Lamentable when it comes to that side, simply because no Christian businessman has moved in and cleared up the mess, moved the clergy off the desks and told them to get on with their job. Simple principle, isn't it? She had done what lay in her power. How many ministers and pastors are laid aside with a coronary or a severe illness in their 40s or 50s because they don't see this thing, or rather their people don't remind them, for we're all blind and we need reminding. He has done what she could. That's all that God asks, isn't it? He doesn't ask more than that. Well, if this man, this minister, this pastor can't do all the visiting, somebody else must do it. Tremendously important principle, isn't it? Very great comfort. Very sane. But there's also, of course, a dynamic challenge. I hope you don't think that I'm letting you off lightly. Because I find this a very challenging statement, too. She's done what she could. Well, could we say that? Could I say that? Often not. Often I fail in trying to win someone for Christ because I haven't prayed for them as I could. Oh, I can make 105 excuses why I hadn't time to pray, and so can you. I'm brilliant at it. You see, it is also a challenge, and say, a very simple one, isn't it? Have we done what we can? Have we done what we can in giving? Have we done what we can in praying for that next door neighbor? I sometimes wonder if this key isn't the key to the lives of the great stalwarts of the Bible. You see, you can't say that David was entirely consecrated always. He made many mistakes. But he was wholehearted. Same for Caleb. I think if you look at the great saints of the Old Testament and New Testament, you can find in them many warts and many faults and many failures, but they were at least wholehearted. They did get up and go on. They didn't compromise, and they weren't lukewarm. And so with all their massive faults, God used them mightily. Well, now, there are the simple hints that I give you. I believe they're well worth thinking out. I think, actually, that there is a wealth of thought-provoking material in that story. Here are the two principles. She's done it for me. Christ has got to be at the center. She has done what she could. That is what God asks. We are all different. Different gifts, different capacities, different opportunities.